Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, number 66. My name is Antonia Chen, and I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. And I have my colleague here, Andrew Schoenfeld, who is deputy editor of Method.
Looking forward to our conversation.
As always, we have a good time. As always, too, these opinions are 100% our own. They do not represent anyone at JBJS, and they do not constitute anyone's background at all whatsoever. So these are just our opinions and us talking. So thanks for listening. This is brought to you by JBJS CME. If you need your CME credits, which we know you need in a lot of different states, get on board, go read some articles, learn some things, and get some CME at the same time. So without further ado, we're going to start off with top of the pile, what's new in hip surgery. It's by Howard and et al. It's permanently free. There's also, what are the social determinants of health and why should they matter to an orthopedic surgeon, by Maycock. A discussion of the 2023 American Orthopedic Association, Japanese Orthopedic Association, the AOA-JOA Traveling Fellowship, by Balach. What's important? Get out of the chair, by Perkel, and it's permanently free. The role of institutional review boards in improving the inclusion of sex and gender as variables in clinical research, by Bier. And the role of gender in health and disease, methods of reporting and interactions with sex and other factors, by Scheibinger. We're going to move on to our headlines next. I'm going to kick us off with talking about synovial fluid Cutibacterium acnes antigen is detected among shoulder samples with high inflammation and early culture growth. This is by Toller et al., and it is permanently free. It's an interesting topic. The idea of C. acnes, which is formerly known as P. acnes, came out in shoulder infections, and because the idea of shoulder infections is pretty controversial. There have been increased amounts of C. acnes, and that's, I think, because we're looking for it more, right? We hold samples for longer, we hold them for 14 days, and so there may be improved detection of holding cultures and increased suspicion of this organism, and the use of molecular methods such as PCR and next-generation sequencing have probably increased the risk, the rate of diagnosing this organism, especially in shoulder infections, given the increased amount of hair follicles. But there are still false positives. You've all gotten it before where you're in a laboratory setting and they give you a call and they're like, well, cannot rule out contaminant or not. And you have a C. acnes on day 13 of culture. So how do we determine if a C. acnes infection is real or a false positive? And this study tried to answer that specifically in shoulder infections. And this is looking at the host inflammatory response and the time to C. acnes culture growth as it may distinguish true infections from contamination. A clinical retrospective study was performed examining the relationship between C. acnes antigen, C. acnes culture results, and inflammation. And the study was conducted from January 2021 to January 2023, looking at 1,365 periprosthetic synovial fluid samples from 347 institutions, because this is through a centralized database, otherwise known as SynovaSure. And SynovaSure gets synovial fluid from hips, knees, shoulders, all different body parts here. So it's a good compendium of data. Now, I will say the only downside about this is that because this is a big database of samples, we don't have clinical data on any of these individuals because these are all basically identified to the patient and this institution, but are not tied to any medical records. Samples were assayed for host response inflammatory biomarkers and could only be assessed for synovial fluid ones, right? Because synovial fluid is being sent in not serum, they could only test synovial fluid C-reactive protein, synovial fluid alpha defensin, synovial fluid white blood cell count, and synovial fluid polymorphonuclear cell count. Sample inclusion needed to be fluid from the shoulder, C. acnes antigen immunoassay available, synovial fluid culture also sent, and all four inflammatory host response biomarker tests, and the receipt by the laboratory within 6 days of aspiration. What was this biomarker scoring system? It was based on the 2018 ICM definition of infection to assign an inflammatory score. So because there was no serum, CRP, they replaced this with synovial fluid CRP, and that gave you 2 points. positive alpha defensin, which gave you 3 points, positive synovial fluid white blood cell count, which is 3 points, and a positive synovial fluid polymorphic nucleocytes of 2 points, allowing for a possible total of 7 points. Now, please keep in mind that when you do look at this 2018 International Consensus Meeting definition, alpha defensin or white blood cell counts are in the same category, so you can only get 3 points for either one. You can't get 3 points for both of them. Associations between inflammation, culture results, and C-acne antigen results were assessed using cluster and correlation analysis. The silhouette coefficient was used to calculate the goodness of the clustering, and Spearman rank order method was used to estimate correlations between non-parametric values. I'm going to ask Dr. Schoenfeld, after I go through this summary, on what his thoughts are on the stats on the study, because there were a lot of numbers. So of these 1,365 samples, 1,150 were culture negative and 215 were culture positive. Of the culture positive, only 94 of them were C. acne. So it's a small amount out of the entire cohort, and 121 were other organisms. Among the 94 C. acne positive cultures, this unsupervised clustering revealed two distinct clusters, a high inflammation cluster and a low inflammation cluster. C. acne's antigen levels demonstrated moderate positive correlation, specifically with a correlation coefficient of 0.6 with inflammation, and they had a 166-fold higher levels of C. acne's antigen in higher inflammation samples compared to low inflammation samples. The days to C. acne's culture positivity had a weak inverse correlation with inflammation, with 1.5-fold earlier growth among the high inflammation samples versus the low inflammation samples. Elevated C. acne's of note was only observed in 0.4% of the low inflammation culture negative samples and in only 5% of the high inflammation non-C. acne's positive cultures. However, 19% of high inflammation culture negative samples demonstrated elevated C. acne's antigen. What do that mean? So going forward, it'd be interesting to evaluate if an inflammatory score in all patients while taking antigen and culture results into account would help us diagnose infection, not just for C. acne's infections, but all infections. And it really would be meaningful to include clinical data and serum data in our patients, not just synovial fluid data, which this database did not include. But interestingly enough, looking at the synovial fluid C. acne's antigen and looking at high inflammatory patients, these patients had a higher likelihood of having faster culture growth, and it supports the paradigm that C. acne's antigen could potentially be used as an adjunct in diagnosing our periprosthetic joint infections, especially around the shoulder.
So I didn't have a problem with how the analyses were done. I think it's really well done from a method standpoint. My thoughts around this are, we've seen a lot of studies, not necessarily in the C. acne's or shoulder area, but with like a lot of these like sonication studies and super high sensitivity tests, primarily around infection in total knees, total hips. And, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind, especially when you're talking about bacteria, but even viruses, right? Like, it's not just that you happen to find the presence of an organism. It's that you find the presence of the organism in a sufficiently large capacity where it can cause some type of problem, either localized or systemic, right? So, you know, like, let's use an analogy. Always in the case of bacteria, you want, like, there's a certain number of like colony forming units. It's not the presence that there's, we found a bacteria floating around. It's that there's 40,000, 50,000, over 100,000 colony forming units. That's kind of the classic threshold that I'm recalling from my USMLE step first aid for step two way back when. But I think that's still valid. And, you know, if you liken it to like viruses, you'll have a test for a virus and that detects like the antibody, right? Which means that there was an exposure, but that doesn't mean that there's actually virus in the system or virus at levels that are virulent enough that they're going to impact the patient's health. So then you might do a confirmatory test, PCR or something like that, to see how many viral replicates are present. And if you have an antibody test that's positive, but the viral replicates are zero, meaning there's not actually any virus present in the system, then that's not, you know, what's not there can't affect the patient. And as our technology grows to where we can detect things that are at such a minuscule level, the presence of C. acne's antigen Could that be like there's like three C. acnes organisms present? And three C. acnes organisms, whether it's, you know, a contaminant or just from the skin or whatever it may be, that's probably not going to cause an infection, right? So I just wonder if we're getting to the point where the sensitivity is so high that we're finding things that are not likely to cause a problem downstream. I don't think that's this study can answer this one way or the other. It's demonstrating the utility, but then what you do with that information, I think, is the bigger question.
And that's the hard part about it. I think this is one of those things where it's an adjunct. It's just like next generation sequencing. We can't just take this information and run with it and expect it to be totally fine. So I agree with you. Keeps it interesting. All right. So moving on to the next topic, we're going to talk in the headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld is going to talk about posterior cervical foraminotomy compared with anterior cervical discectomy with fusion for cervical radiculopathy. 2-year results of the FACET, well-named, randomized non-inferiority study by Samoas D'Souza et al., and it's permanently free.
Yes. So this work is a randomized controlled trial, the report of a randomized controlled trial. Posterior cervical surgery is an alternative at times to anterior cervical discectomy and fusion. I think that the enthusiasm for its use has decreased to some degree, at least in our system. There was a real sea change. I think it goes without saying that orthopedic surgeons are associated with sports, and a lot of orthopedic surgeons, I think, are into sports. And I actually think there was a real sea change when Peyton Manning, Hall of Fame quarterback, previously with the Indianapolis Colts and then with the Denver Broncos, he had a cervical disc herniation. He underwent a posterior foraminotomy that caused more problems than it fixed. And then he had to end up having a revision surgery that I believe was an ACDF. A lot of that experience turned off a lot of surgeons from this kind of approach. The posterior cervical foraminotomy, you know, requires, there's really very limited margin for error. Not that that should be your reason for deciding on one approach versus the other, but the anterior cervical discectomy and fusion is the really tried and true approach and considered to have excellent durability. So this study was conducted as a non-inferiority trial, assessing patients with single-level cervical radiculopathy, 9 Dutch hospitals. They followed them up for 2 years. The primary outcomes measured included cervical radicular pain and a success ratio based on the Odom criteria, arm pain, and decrease in arm pain with the VAS, visual analog scale. They had a 10% non-inferiority margin, which is the MCID basically between posterior surgery and anterior surgery. This was conducted from January 2016 to May 2020. They randomized 265 patients, balanced between the two cohorts. At the 2-year follow-up, primary outcome data was available for 236 individuals. They found that the posterior surgery was non-inferior to ACDF. The between group difference, you know, essentially was marginal, and probably within the margin for error. So they felt with level one evidence, trial demonstrated that after a 2-year follow-up, posterior surgery was non-inferior to anterior surgery with regard to success rate and arm pain reduction in patients with cervical radiculopathy, which is all true. I could see this study showing up on web-based longitudinal assessment. I could see this study showing up on the OITE. I could see this study showing up on part one of the board exam. It's well
Kaiser
done.
Kaiser Sose.
Well, so like Kaiser Sose, again, is like when you don't think it's that
surprise.
Important, right?
That's fair.
This is a randomized study. It probably wouldn't be surprised that like a bunch of people would cite it or choose to use it as a substrate for questions and stuff like that. But I would also say that I think that there's probably a lot of caveats. There's nothing to put on hold here. It's well done from an RCT standpoint. If you wanted to say, like if you said, I'm going to use this study as a template to replicate my RCT, including the write-up, I think that's great. You could absolutely use that, no problem. But I just think there are, you know, a couple of finer points here from more, I guess, the clinical side, which is first off, this is pure single-level cervical radiculopathy. And I would say that the majority of patients that I see in my practice, which granted may be geared more to an older population, they don't have clear-cut one-level cervical radiculopathy. Also, for a posterior cervical foraminotomy, it's going to need to be a relatively like soft disc or some process that's accessible posteriorly. Whereas if you have disc osteophyte complex anteriorly, or there are any changes in the patient's sagittal cervical parameters, this can also threaten the success of the intervention. So this is, I think, an idealized study. And I also think that there's high prospect, as I was kind of hinting at earlier, for, you know, you'd say expertise bias. Like, grant, most of the time when you're talking about expertise bias, you're talking about studies that are done with like one individual. But in this case, this is a procedure, the posterior cervical foraminotomy, that the person who's executing it has to have like a lot of experience, really good training, be technically adept and very skilled at the performing of this intervention. I don't think that like every single person can perform this intervention, especially since it's not that widely used, at least in the practice settings where I've worked. ACDF is kind of the workhorse. So I would say that in the proper hands and in a setting where there's clinical equipoise, where you think both the ACDF and the posterior cervical foraminotomy could be used, this study is saying that, yeah, there's support in you using the posterior cervical foraminotomy. If you did a posterior cervical foraminotomy and you went to part two of the boards and they said, why would you do this, et cetera, you could certainly use this as really good, robust support to enhance your case that that was gold standard of care practice and quality care that was delivered. So, you know, check it out, make of it what you will. There's not a lot of holes here or faults with the paper in and of itself, but I just think there are some caveats in terms of how it would be applied clinically.
I don't have much to add to that. That was pretty well done. Thanks. I appreciate it. And remember, this will be ahead in your tests, so be prepared for it. All right. This next question is talking about the cost effectiveness of computer assisted compared with conventional total knee arthroplasty, a payer's perspective. It's by Tian et al. And it's there's a visual summary with it, and it's free for 30 days. So one complaint about computer-assisted technology, the potential for increased cost. And this study aimed to evaluate the cost-effectiveness of computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty relative to conventional total knee arthroplasty for patients with end-stage knee arthritis from the perspectives of a public payers, which is Medicare, and commercial payers under both the fee-for-service and value-based payment plans in the United States. This study compared these computer-assisted ones with regards to costs in with computer-assisted with conventional, with regards to costs in 2022 U.S. dollars and quality-adjusted life years using Markov models for elderly patients, which they defined as 65 years and greater, and patients who are not elderly, which they defined as 55-year-olds to 64-year-olds. The thought process that patients 65 and older were under Medicare. There were four hypothetical cohorts. The first one was elderly patients reimbursed through a bundled payment program in their lifetime term. The second one was elderly patients reimbursed through a fee-for-service program in the lifetime term. The third one was patients who are not elderly, reimbursed through a bundled payment program in the short term, and patients who are not elderly, reimbursed through a fee-for-service program in the short term. All costs and quality of life were discounted at 3% per year rate. There were two acute states, six chronic states, and an absorbing state, such as death. You had your initial total knee arthroplasty done either conventional or computer-assisted, and you could either have a limited benefit after surgery or full benefit after surgery. This is in figure one. And then they could either continue to have limited benefit or continue to have full benefit or go to implant failure. If they undergo implant failure, they could stay in the implant failure state or go to revision. And after revision, we either go to a full benefit after revision and either stay in that full benefit, or from a revision, go to limited benefit and stay in that limited benefit, or go to a failed revision and stay in that failed revision state. Cost and quality of life were estimated in the lifetime of elderly patients in the short term for patients who are not elderly under the bundle payment and a fee for service. And related costs were identified using the Medicare severity diagnosis related group codes. Complications were defined on the basis of the 2022 CMS risk standardized total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty complication measure. The risk adjusted postoperative complication rates were found to be 2.77% for patients undergoing conventional total knee arthroplasty and 0.4% for patients undergoing computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty. And this was based on a single population-based study, so something to keep a note of. And that was, you know, published as a revisiting short-term outcomes of conventional and computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty, a population-based study published in 2022. And this looked at 90-day readmission and complications. So this is the one study that kind of drove the complication rate. Looking at revision rates, they used the 15-year revision rates after an initial surgical procedure from the Australian Orthopaedic Association National Joint Registry, Joint Replacement Registry, and then non-surgical mortality was estimated from the 2022 age-specific U.S. life tables. And cost, they said there was no difference in cost from the two because it's from the payer's perspective, not a hospital perspective, not from a surgeon's perspective, it's from the payer's perspective, there's no difference in cost. Effectiveness was defined as according to a multi-center randomized controlled trial, the initial qualities 1 year after computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty might be slightly better than those after conventional total knee arthroplasty, but there was no significant difference. The authors conservatively assume that the initial quality for patients who underwent computer-assisted total knee and conventional total knee were the same in the base case analysis. They used two different thresholds and probability sensitivity analyses to conduct, to examine the robustness of key estimates. And using they used projected estimates of total knee arthroplasty utilization until 2023. And they looked at the cost savings, the total cost savings of performing computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty rather than conventional total knee arthroplasty based on a 60%, 80%, and 100% of patients using computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty. And all total knee arthroplasty were presumed to be reimbursed through a bundled payment program. What did they find? They found that compared with conventional total knee arthroplasty, computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty was associated with higher quality, quality-assisted life units and lower cost for both elderly patients and patients who are not elderly, regardless of the payment program. For the cohort of elderly patients who are reimbursed through a bundled payment program in the life term, the total cost associated with the computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty for an elderly patient was $30,609, which was $630 lower than the cost of conventional total knee arthroplasty. The cost savings for elderly for computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty was $623 through a fee-for-service one. The qualities were only marginally difference of 0.001 improvement for computer-assisted versus conventional. For patients who weren't elderly, the short-term costs were lower for computer-assisted ones. What did it mean? So at 3, 5, and 10-year cost savings, the cost savings range from $393 per case to $446 per case. And then for the fee-for-service program, it saved $386 to $438. What the threshold analysis showed that an increase in the first-year QALY quality after computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty resulted in an increase in the lifetime quality from 14.425 to 14.520, which is not incredibly high. And furthermore, a 1% decrease in the 15-year failure rate resulted in a decrease in lifetime cost from 30,609 to 29,862. And the qualities increased from 14.425 to 14.427, only 0.002 difference. The chance of the probabilistic sensitivity analysis suggested that computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty had a 9.3% chance, sorry, 95.3% chance of being cost-effective compared to conventional total knee arthroplasty. And if aggregated altogether, again, looking at the number of total knee arthroplasties performed up until 2023, they stated the lifetime cost savings from Medicare for procedures performed during this time, if done computer-assisted versus conventional, would be $441.6 million for 60% utilization, $588.9 million for 80% utilization, and $736.1 million for 100% utilization. So while the findings did show economic benefit, and the authors concluded that the computer-assisted total knee arthroplasty would have more cost savings from a payer's perspective, I really am concerned that a lot of the findings were driven by one study on postoperative complications that really divided the rate between conventional versus computer-assisted arthroplasty. I'd be curious to see what my deputy editor said in relation to this.
Yeah, so I think, as I mentioned for the last study, if you're trying to do a Markov model, comparing cost-effectiveness with all the sensitivity tests, like the actual methodology and conduct of this work really well done. It could serve as a primer or a template for other individuals who wanted to sort of model what this did in the total joint space or anywhere else that you're looking to apply a Markov model. Really good write-up, really clear. They touch on all the elements. necessary for a study like this. But as you say, and I think we do see this a lot, my question is this amplification or is this a new paradigm that's being reached? And that's an important question. Amplification means you're taking the elements of like this one study, as you said, and you're just exploding them by building this, what is a simulation. You're creating a Sims computer game out of the one study. And then instead of the study being done in however many patients it was done, now you're pretending like it was done in millions and millions of patients. But because it's just based on the information from that one study with some, you know, potential variation built in, you're really going to be, it's unlikely that you're going to find a difference. You're just going to show an amplified version, which can be misleading to some people because they think it's actually representative of a new research achievement has been unlocked, so to speak, when in reality, it's just a carnival, like a carnival hall of mirrors, kind of, right? You're taking something that's small, you're putting it in front of a mirror, and the mirror makes it look really big. So that's a question that we can't really answer, although we can suggest that it's probably present. The answer has to come from people who want to use this. Now, in a Socratic exercise, let's just try to poke a few holes in this or things that I thought was relevant, recognizing I'm not someone who does joint arthroplasty. But let me just ask you these questions. And I have what I think the answers are, but I want to hear your answers. So the first thing is that this is a payer's perspective, as you mentioned, right? Which means it's not taking the surgeon and it's not taking the hospital into account. So the benefit, the perceived benefits from computer-assisted surgery are going to be like more precise cuts, less margins for error, the implants are going to be placed better, and that theoretically is going to decrease the risk of revision, right?
That's the theory of it. Yes, I agree. That's the theoretical. If it's more precise and accurate, and you're less likely to undergo a revision, but that has not been borne out in the long term yet.
Okay, but that seems to be like kind of what they're modeling here. Like they're basing that on the assumption. The assumption is that the computer assisted is going to lower the risk of revision. And I'm saying that the underpinning etiology for that is more precise cuts, et cetera. Computer assisted surgery should take longer. Yes or no?
The studies are mixed in that. Most of the studies show that it does take a little bit longer to add on technology, probably including learning curves as well.
Because like I've worked in places where there have been some joint surgeons who are doing the total knee in like 45 minutes, like skin to skin.
Yep.
Can you do that with computer assisted?
You can, but if there's a learning curve in the beginning, probably not off the bat.
Yeah, ignore the learning curve part. Just once you hit the level of mastery that you need to say, I'm technically adept at doing this procedure. So that can be done. Mm-hmm. So there are no concerns about risks from longer operative times to increase risk of infection, or slower turnover time from the hospital standpoint or anything along those lines?
So that's the hard part about things. A slower turnover time wouldn't affect outcomes, right? Because it wouldn't necessarily...
No. I'm not talking about affecting the outcomes. I'm talking about this is why when it's a payer's perspective, but when it's the hospital's perspective and you're losing a case, or you're the surgeon's perspective and you're losing a case...
You're completely 1,000% right. That's always a thing. That the cost to the payer is different. And I think that's why they chose the payer option as opposed to cost to the surgeon.
And it's not... The other construct that I found weird is that the payers are not buying the robot. The payers are not...
They are not.
...purchasing the robot for the hospital.
They're definitely not purchasing the robot. Right? That is correct. That is not new.
You know, while it is a really nice study... And they're talking about all of these savings that can accrue to payers. Mm-hmm. If the same is achieved by a really adept surgeon who can work really fast and, you know, makes precise cuts on their own, like if they can work as well as the robot, you don't need the robot. The savings will accrue to the payers no matter what. So they're really speaking to the wrong audience here. When you're doing a payer's perspective, that means you're speaking to the payers. And the payers are like, I don't care if you do the robot or not. Like, correct. Just make sure the outcomes are super great and no revisions. And if you're like, well, we spent, you know, $1 billion on this robot to help us with these surgeries, the payer's like, okay, sure, here's the bundle that I'm going to pay you anyway.
you're going to get the same amount, and that's what it is at the end of the day.
Yeah. So doing it from a payer's perspective just comes across as kind of odd to me, because it's not the payers that make these decisions and even care at the end of the day. You have to make the case to the hospital that it's going to impact their bottom line. And I'm not sure that it does.
That's the hard part. It does not show that at all. And to be fair, they didn't mean to set out to do that. But looking at the grand scheme of things, where is the biggest change or biggest impact would be? I agree, it would probably be that.
So, I mean, nothing wrong with the study at all. Mm-mm. For those who want to use it to support your institution getting a robot, I think it's fine. But if you give it to your financial people at the hospital and they start actually reading it, they're going to say, I don't really see how this helps us one way or the other.
Totally agree. So this will be interesting to see how this bears out at the end. So interesting discussion. One of those things where we will see.
Yeah, it was really good discussion this episode.
I like this.
This is the really good discussion episode.
That's what we're going to call this one, guys.
Right.
Thanks for being aboard for this. We're going to finish this up with some honorable mentions. I'm going to talk about using multimodal assessments to reevaluate depression designations for spine surgery candidates. Benedisic et al., and there's a commentary on it. Depression is common in spine surgery candidates and may influence postoperative outcomes. And this study found that a history of depression in the medical record is not a reliable indication of preoperative depression symptom severity. Cross-sectional depression assessments such as the Patient Health Questionnaire 9 have stronger associations with daily depression symptoms, but may conflate somatic depression symptoms with spine-related disability. As an alternative to these methods, mobile health technology and ecological momentary assessments provide an opportunity to collect real-time longitudinal data on depression symptom severity, potentially improving prognostic accuracy. The next one is 3D printed metaphyseal cones and revision total knee arthroplasties. Excellent survivorship of 740 cones at 5 years by Carinder et al. This is a large series of 740 cones, of which 498 of them were tibial, 242 were femoral, show that 3D printed titanium metaphyseal cones were very durable at short-term follow-up, with the 5-year cumulative incidence of cone revision for aseptic loosening of 1%. Periprosthetic joint infection was the most common reason for cone revision and any revision. Integrated dual lag screws have higher reoperation rates for fixation failure than single lag component cephalomedullary nails. A retrospective study of 2,130 patients with intertrochanteric femoral fractures by Gonzalez et al. Is an infographic for this. Intertrochanteric femoral fractures treated with an integrated dual lag screw cephalomedullary nail were associated with low, significantly higher rates and significantly higher odds of reoperation for fixation failure and all-cause reoperation compared to those treated with a single lag component cephalomedullary nail. Consider using a single lag component cephalomedullary nail for most patients with intertrochanteric femoral fractures, especially high-risk patients. And finally, in vivo intraarticular antibiotic concentration at 24 hours after total knee arthroplasty while below the minimum inhibitory concentration for most bacteria, a randomized study of commercially available bone cement by Liz Cano et al. The good news is you got the entire answer to the study in the title. The elution of antibiotics from commercially available antibiotic cement decreased rapidly following total knee arthroplasty, and only at 4 hours postoperatively did the mean antibiotic concentration exceed the mean inhibitory concentration for most of the pathogens. Samples were collected at the 4-hour mark and the 24-hour mark. Gentamicin concentrations reached MBEC, which is the minimum biothreal threshold, values at 4 hours only for the least virulent strains of Staph aureus and E. coli. Tobramycin concentrations did not reach the MBEC threshold for any of the bacteria at either time point. The use of commercially available ALBC may not provide substantial antimicrobial coverage following total knee arthroplasty, and really doesn't go past the 4-hour mark. So if you're looking for something to elute longer, maybe antibiotic cement is not the way to go. That's it for us. That's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed us, and please tune in next time.